Hi everyone. Today I am speaking to Professor Kate Dossett. And Kate is Professor of American History here in the School of History at the University of Leeds. Kate is the author of the prize-winning book Bridging Race Divides: Black Nationalism, Feminism, and Integration in the United States, 1896 to 1935. And the reason we're talking today, Kate has recently published in 2020 Radical Black Theatre in the New Deal with the University of North Carolina Press. Kate, thanks so much for making the time. I wanted to kind of start off by asking you about how you got here, about your career in research and how your ideas and interests have developed.
Hi, John. It's great to be here. I think like many UK-based historians of the Americas, my interest in the United States really came out of my interest in histories of race. And I think it's really interesting to think about how British higher education has so many experts on race relations in the United States and on African American history. And so I came out of this tradition then of British students who are really interested in histories of race. And there's a really interesting history there, I think, about how we often displace conversations about race onto the United States. And that's certainly something that there are many debates happening about that at the moment in British higher education and I think across society more broadly. So I started studying the US Civil War and out of that, the history of the civil rights movement in the United States. And I really became interested in this moment in the 1920s and 30s called the Harlem Renaissance. And the Harlem Renaissance is this extraordinary time when African American women and men are creating poetry, writing novels, creating new artwork, putting on plays, and finding people to pay for it. And I guess that issue of white patronage, of how African Americans navigate the gatekeepers of culture, is one of the things that's always interested me. And I guess that's been a thread that's run through my first work, which very much focused on African American women as creatives, through to the current projects that I do now, which is looking at the history of theatre. And I guess it's a real luxury, and one of the amazing things about this job, when we get to focus on the history of things that we're also personally very interested in. So I love theatre, and I love thinking about how theatre can change the world. So to be able to explore those histories in my professional life is a real pleasure.
I think it's fantastic. So we study very different periods. I'm an early modernist, but a lot of how I came to that period was through an interest in the culture and art of the period, and kind of using that to crack open questions that are historical, I think is always such an interesting and rewarding approach. I wanted to kind of hear a little more about your new book, Radical Black Theatre in the New Deal. And to start off, I wondered if you could give us a kind of elevator pitch for the book.
Yeah, well, not many Americans and perhaps not many people across the world know that there was this moment in US history when the United States federal government paid unemployed theatre makers to produce theatre. And this often astonishes people because one of the definitions of being a theatre maker is, in some people's mind, is that you're often unemployed. And of course, this is something that really is affecting the theatre industry around the world during the current global pandemic. But about 85 years ago, the United States was in the grip of the greatest economic crisis it had ever faced. And the US government was really trying to think about how to deal with extraordinary high rates of unemployment, of poverty, of suffering. And it decided that rather than furloughing people, rather than paying people to sit at home and do nothing, they would pay people a living wage to do the things that they had been trained to do. So that included manual labor. So they built bridges, they created a new infrastructure, they built roads. They brought in electrification to many areas of the rural South that didn't have it. But they also recognized that artists go hungry during recessions too. And so they set up this federal arts program for musicians, for theatre makers, for artists, and for writers. And there's also a bit of help for people who are interested in history too. And they set up this federal arts program run by the federal government that paid unemployment artists to do what they were trained to do. And they also wanted to encourage them to create exciting, experimental, and innovative art. So my book looks very specifically at one part of this arts programme, which was called the Federal Theatre Programme. And it set up a whole range of different theatre units around the US. So they set up vaudeville units, they set up circus units, they set up units for children's theatre, for classics. People who have heard of this project, if they've heard of it at all, might know about Orson Welles. He was involved in this Harlem so-called Negro unit. And they included these 17 Negro units, which were set up around the country. And they were separate units. We could say they were segregated units. But they were comprised almost entirely of African-American theatre professionals, of directors, of playmakers, of actors, of technicians. Often they were supervised by a white person, which was by no means unusual in the context of the 1930s. So there were limitations to these units. But importantly, they paid unemployed African-American theatre makers to create exciting and innovative new theatre. So my book looks at that theatre that was created by African-Americans between 1935 and 1939, this period, four-year period, when the Federal Theatre Project seemed to reshape what theatre meant in the United States.
It's just an incredibly fascinating moment and project. I wondered about radicalism here, because you talk about this, of course, as being radical forms of theatre. What is radical in the theatre that's being made by these groups?
Yeah, no, that's a really great question, because I use it in the title of the book and I explore the theme of radicalism throughout. And I guess one of the things I'm getting at is, I think when we think about Black culture, whether we think about it today in the UK or the history of Black culture and how we get to know about it and who gets to access it, we're often struck by the role of white gatekeepers. And the Federal Theatre Project has white gatekeepers, and theatre has white gatekeepers. So whether this is the publishing industry or white producers, and even though this is a project run by the government, so it has to be accountable to its African-American constituents, as I suggested earlier, they appoint white people to oversee it and to run these units. Even so, I argue we can find the seeds of a radical Black theatre tradition. And one of the ways we're able to access this and we know about it is because of the Black theatre manuscripts that were produced on the project. So even though many of these manuscripts don't get staged, many of them do get edited, or we might even see examples of censorship, they still exist and they still circulated. And so what they show us is that there's this archive of Black agency, that African Americans were coming together in these communities. We're using the resources of the federal government to create provocative and radical work, work which challenged the narratives that America likes to tell itself about its history of freedom, of equality, of democracy, and challenges the ways in which African Americans have been positioned within white society. So there's lots of radical activism taking place around these so-called Negro units. The Communist Party is very much involved, for example. Lots of people are lobbying to have their vision and version of the world included on the stage. But what I'm really interested in is how Black theatre makers seize this opportunity to imagine a radically different future for America.
That's fantastic. I mean, that idea of agency is one that I wanted to pick up on, because, you know, you've talked about the agency displayed by Black performance communities in kind of working with play texts and sometimes maybe pushing back against texts or ideas. I wondered if there were any examples of that or any moments that really spring to mind that show the agency of these communities from that archive.
Yeah, so I think often when we think about theatre manuscripts, we think about the polished, finished product. We might access it, if we access it at all, through a theatre anthology, or we might think about the version that's performed on the stage, how critics write about it. So these are all some of the tools that theatre historians use to try and get a sense of how that play was performed at the time. I'm really interested in what are variant manuscripts. So we have many different versions of the same manuscript. And I guess anyone with an interest in Shakespeare might be familiar with this, right? We talk about folios, first folios. And what I'm trying to do is look at how these manuscripts changed over time and who shaped what was performed and when. So in some ways, I'm interested in what version was actually performed. But I think even more interesting than that is looking at what shaped which version was performed. And one of the things that shaped which version was performed was the audience. So audiences routinely came along to critique a play, to say that doesn't represent our community. I really hate what you've done there. And one particularly interesting example is a play by an African-American playwright called Theodore Ward. And he was a sort of playwright in resident, or he became a de facto playwright in resident at the Chicago Negro Units. And the supervisor there was a woman called Shirley Graham. And later Shirley Graham Du Bois, because she married the very prominent and brilliant African-American intellectual W.E.B. Du Bois. And under her supervision, the Chicago Negro Unit put on this play by Theodore Ward called Big White Fog. And the play examines different political options available to African-Americans in the 1930s during the Great Depression. So communism, which was big news around the world and a really powerful influence in 1930s America, but also Black nationalism. So the play examines Marcus Garvey and the Universal Negro Association, which was very prominent and important, and in fact the first mass Black movement in the United States in the 1920s. So this play, written in the 1930s, was written for the troupe. Theodore Ward was an actor on the troupe. He knew his cast, and he knew the community. And the play seems to debate which political solution is best for African Americans. And it's often read as a communist play, because lots of plays in the 1930s had this regulation finish. It's a bit like Jane Austen novels, right? There's always a marriage finish, or a Shakespeare play, you know, a comedy, there's often couples are married up. And in 1930s plays, often it ends with unionists coming together and throwing off the big, bad, evil employer. And so Ward's play does seem to follow that formula. And historians therefore think that this was a controversial play because it explored communism, but it also explored Black nationalism. It also explored capitalism, and it questioned all of those actually. So what looking at these different and variant theatre manuscripts has enabled me to unpack and get a handle on is the fact that for Black performance communities in Chicago, it wasn't the communist politics so much. It wasn't really the Black nationalist politics either. Some people believed in some of those, others were Black nationalists. What was really challenging to these audiences was the ways in which Black women were represented in the play. So it was particularly the gender politics of this play. It was the intra-race racism that we see staged in this play, particularly really difficult questions around colorism. So for example, we have a Black grandmother showing colorism towards her own grandson. And these were really uncomfortable and difficult issues to explore on a theater stage in front of an interracial audience. So audiences are made up of white people, of African Americans, of immigrants, of working class people, because to go to the theatre on the Federal Theatre Project as an audience member, you perhaps didn't have to pay anything. So a lot of the tickets were free. Or if you did pay something, it was a really nominal sum. So theatre was available to the masses. Unions often booked book group tickets. So you might go along and be sitting with your work colleague. And so you'd be in this atmosphere where you felt comfortable with other people from work, even if you'd never been to the theatre before. And it's estimated that the Federal Theatre Project as a whole reached 30 million Americans during this four-year programme. So Big White Fog is a really interesting example, I think, of why we need to pay attention to Black theatre manuscripts, but also why audiences matter. Because one of the other really exciting things for a historian about the Federal Theatre Project was that they did audience surveys. And although if you go to the theatre today, you might be really familiar with getting an email afterwards or being asked to fill in a form. Actually, this was really new in the 1930s, that you sat there at the interval and you told the players what you thought about their play.
It must have been terrifying for actors, but absolutely brilliant for the historian, right, to be able to find that. Something you pointed towards in that answer that I'm really interested to know more about is the role of Black women in this story. What have you been able to find?
Yeah, so the Federal Theatre Project as a whole was not the best employer of black women, particularly not when it came to creative roles. So African American women were employed on the project in a whole range of roles as seamstresses, as actresses. So there were a large number of women acting on the project, and Shirley Graham-Du Bois was one of the very few women in a senior position. Perhaps more than anything, what's really disappointing about it is the ways in which the role of a playwright is figured as a masculine role. So there are very, very, very few black women who appear as officially credited playwrights. And that seems really odd to me, not least because African American women have always written plays. And in fact, in the 1920s and the 1930s, this period of literary renaissance in Harlem, in Chicago, in Washington, D.C., and other major urban centres, black women are writing and staging lots and lots of plays. They're publishing them, they're setting up their own magazines to publish plays. So I wasn't quite sure why the Federal Theatre Project seemed to have so few plays written by black women. And there are all kinds of structural reasons for this. There's the sexism and racism that's built into the Federal Theatre Project itself. It's the fact that the people in charge of it are often men and often white men. But I think actually more than anything, it's to do with how the theatre industry gives or denies credit to black women as authors. So I wanted to find another way of getting at the role of black women in shaping theatre manuscripts, because I knew that they were there. And one of the ways I was able to do this was by thinking about who actually creates manuscripts. So in theatre history, and I think still in contemporary society, we're w really wedded to this idea that a play is authored by one person. And of course, Shakespeare scholars are really sort of wary and interesting on this point too. You know, is there one author that creates one text? I think in the context of the Federal Theatre Project, a project that was designed to be collaborative, was designed to bring people together. They often worked on a manuscript for weeks and weeks and weeks. And in that, we see in the archives of the Federal Theatre, but much more in the personal papers of African American women and in oral history interviews that were done about 30 or 40 years later, we see that Black women often wrote whole scenes within these plays, or they really shaped the ending of a play, or they made a series of alterations throughout it. And finding evidence of that is really tricky, but the evidence is there. So one of the things that I argue in the book is that we need to stop, we need to not go into our research by assuming that there's no evidence of Black agency, there's no evidence of the agency of Black women. Because if we do that, we repeat that cycle where we expect to see a male author assigned to a play, and we don't do that digging around. We don't think creatively about how we can look and find evidence of that agency. So I think the book and the methodology I use has real implications actually for how we do theatre research, and requires us to move away from this model where there's an individual male genius who's developed this brilliant play that's sprung out of his head ideally in a couple of weeks, and we celebrate him and we applaud him and we bring him onto the stage. Because I think if we look at the broader history of theatre making, you know, in many cultures and across the world and across time, we know that theatre was always and will always be a collaborative art form. And maybe that's what's so brilliant and exciting about it.
Absolutely. I mean, these things, it's so often a self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it? If you say, oh, well, I'm not going to find X in the archive, then it determines how you look and what you look for. And actually opening up to what you might find can really reveal so much more. That's really interesting. I wanted to ask about the idea of the archive, because this is something that motivates this project and the current projects that you're working on as well. And just a big question, really, which is, you know, what does the archive mean to you?
Oh, that's such a nice and challenging question at the same time. I mean, I think there's something very special about archives, isn't there? I've yet to meet a historian who doesn't have a great archive story, or who can't remember the first archive they ever went to. And in my teaching, I teach quite a lot about archives and knowledge production, because for me, it's not just a, you know, a methodology. We need to talk about our methods and then we can move on to the real stuff. Actually, our engagement with the archive is a fundamental part of the stories that we tell and what we're trying to do as historians. So I always ask students to tell me an archive story, particularly, you know, at level three and for master students. We talk a lot about what the archive means to me. And I suppose the story I tell, which perhaps helps answer your question, is an experience I had as a PhD student. And I was living in New York City and I was trying to find an archive document that I knew existed because I'd seen it cited in the work of a brilliant scholar called Judith Weisenfeld. And it was a Black woman's history of the Young Women's Christian Association. And she had written an account of the Harlem branch of the YWCA in New York City. And it was a really different account to the official accounts written by white supervisors who ran the Young Women's Christian Association in that city. I couldn't find it anywhere. Eventually I got in contact with Judith and she agreed to meet me for a coffee, and she brought with her a photocopy of this missing document. And this missing document, it had gone missing from the archive. She had photocopied it, but her house had been flooded. She'd had it in the basement and it was waterlogged. So this photocopy was hard to read, even harder to read than a photocopy of an archival document normally is. And she lent it to me and she stayed in the cafe while I went round the corner to a local store and photocopied, because she didn't want to let it out of her hands. And I don't blame her, given the long and troubled history of this 150 page manuscript. So I gave it back to Judith. I had my copy. And I used it a lot for my first book, Bridging Race Divides, because it's really interested in how women narrate their own histories of activism. Some years later, for some reason, I went to look at the YWCA papers and it still wasn't there, even though I had donated my copy of it to the YWCA. And I won't go into the longer, long history of this, but just to say that the YWCA archive was held in the Empire State Building. So I had the privilege of doing research in their archives in the Empire State Building, and I deposited my photocopy into their archive. It went missing again. And some years later, this came to my attention. And for the second time, I have donated this archive, this important archive material. And what's really interesting now is that my name is listed in this archive because I am officially the donor of this manuscript. And of course, I'm a white woman doing African-American women's history. It's not mine to donate. It's not my work. It's the work of scholars such as Judith Weisenfeld and very many others who have labored really hard to make sure Black women's voices are centered in the archive. So I think this story just encapsulates the drama, the excitement, but also the precarity of the archive and all of those feelings, that idea of precariousness, of loss, of excitement, of a discovery, of a find. They're kind of problematic feelings, but they're also ones that it's hard to ignore every time you go to a new archive.
I kind of genuinely felt my heart kind of go through the floor when you mentioned the word flood. It's a real kind of across the centuries. I really feel I feel that story very strongly. I have one last question, Kate, if that's okay, which is to ask about, and you kind of touched on it in your last answer, but I wanted to ask a little bit about how the research that you do and your research interests informs the kind of teaching that you do at Leeds. If you could tell us just a little bit about that.
Yeah, I would say it informs my teaching at every level, actually. And I think partly the ways in which you do research and how you experience it and how you're able to share that with your students. So even if you're teaching something that's not directly related to the last thing that you've worked on, I think there's broader questions about archives, about respecting the archive, respecting the people whose labour produced this work. I think that's very much something that informs my teaching. Generally. But I suppose I'd also say that teaching often reforms my research too. So, you know, I teach very closely to my subject. I teach Black culture, I teach the Harlem Renaissance. And one of the things that has been really exciting about teaching at Leeds is the number of students who bring their own expertise, their own experiences into the classroom, perhaps because they're interested in or making theatre themselves, or they're writers or they're journalists. And I think because all of us are more than just being a history professor, or we're more than just being a history student, it's really important that we bring those other aspects of our lives and our approach to the world into the classroom, So I guess I have learned a lot from my students about how their lives have shaped their access to knowledge, how their lives have shaped the assumptions they make about what they're going to find. So although, you know, my years of thinking about archives, about knowledge production, about who controls those historical narratives give me a particular set of approaches to teaching, equally, I find that students come into the classroom already thinking about how their expectations, their knowledge of the past is shaped by their schooling, you know, what they know about Black history, for example, how many students have studied Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, but haven't studied very many African-American women and haven't studied very, very much Black British history. So I suppose I would, rather than saying research informs my teaching, I would say research, teaching, and student knowledge inform each other. And when that works well, that's a really exciting and challenging dynamic, which makes it such a pleasure to have the opportunity to teach so many students.
It really is. I always come away from these interviews being desperate to take my colleagues' classes, and this is no different. Kate, thank you so much for making the time.
Great to see you this morning, John.
You too. Bye-bye.